What do we talk about when we talk about Ted Williams? I'm Christopher Lighton, and this is Open Source. Our friend Ben Bradley Jr. has written 800 pages on the subject of baseball's greatest hitter, and I told him I read and loved every word of it. But we've also dared each other to get the epic of Teddy Ball Game down to 10 stories or pictures or memories or shivering emotions that never fade. So, Ben, let's plunge. Let me begin. My best Ted Williams story came from Warren Spahn of the Boston Braves, who won the pennant in 1948, the team that inspired that line, Spahn, Sane, and Pray for Rain, two Hall of Fame pitchers and not much else. 40 years later, Warren Spahn came back to Boston for a reunion of that team, what was left of it, and he very graciously came to talk about it on our 10 o'clock news, and it was wonderful. But I said, isn't it curious that you, probably the greatest left-handed pitcher that ever played the game, never pitched to arguably the greatest left-handed hitter that ever played the game. And he said, oh, yes, I did. And like all those ball players, he remembered every pitch, every seam on the ball. And the first time might have been in 1951 or two in Bradenton or Sarasota, wherever they did spring training. And he struck out Ted Bloody Williams. And he was overwhelmed. And the best part of it was that Williams took him aside after the game and said, you have the best pitch in baseball. It's the hardest pitch, and nobody throws it better. A high slider, as I remember he said. And Warren Spahn was already a star, but this was hearing it from God. 1956, Detroit, All-Star Game. Warren Spahn comes in the middle of the game. Here's Ted Williams. So he knows what he's going to do. And he throws in this high slider, and Ted Williams crushed it. I mean, 500 feet or whatever. He said, the ball is still going. And he was furious with himself for thinking, you know, double thinking, overthinking. And he was kicking the mound. And he turned as Williams was going around second base. And he said, you son of a bitch, you planned that. And Williams, he said, just gave him this big shit-eating grin and kept running. That was what they were like.
Yeah, yeah. I have a story that's similar to that, and it's my favorite Williams story. It was the mid-50s, and the Red Sox are playing the old Washington Senators at Fenway Park. And on the mound for the Senators was Pedro Ramos, who was a rookie and a Cuban. And Ted comes up, and Ramos struck him out, which was very unusual. Ted hardly ever struck out. Ramos was beside himself with excitement. And in an act of great chutzpah, after the game is over, he decided to take the ball that he struck out Williams with, barge into the Red Sox clubhouse, approaches the great man, and asks him to sign the ball that he struck him out with. And Ted said, get the blankety blank out of here with that ball. I'll never sign it. But somebody persuaded him to sign the ball. So Ramos takes this prized possession back to his clubhouse. Fast forward 2 or 3 weeks later, the Senators are back in town. Ted comes up, and Ramos is pitching again. And Ted comes up, puts the first pitch 20 rows up in the bleachers. And he's rounding third in his home run trot. Yells over to Ramos, I'll sign that son of a bitch too if you can find it.
That's a beauty. It's better than Spahn, except Spahn was better than Ramos. So, you know, we used to see him. I think of numerous times. He used to do the Sportsman Show in the winter. He would actually come up from Florida, and he would stand there at the edge of this sort of indoor pool, and there would be a guy standing at the other end of the pool with a cigarette sticking out of his mouth.
Yes,
and
he
would cast and snap the thing right
about
out of
100
the
yards or whatever.
Yeah,
snap the cigarette right off. He was extremely skilled. You know, I'm not a fishing devotee, but I had to devote a separate chapter to it because Williams was so passionate about it and so good at it. I don't know if you know, but he's in two fishing halls of fame. They have one for freshwater and one for saltwater fishing. And I sort of get into fishing as an example of the way he strived for excellence in anything he did. He just wouldn't undertake something in a half-assed manner, if you will. And
he told Richard Ben Cramer, he said, nobody knows more about fish than I do, except maybe God. And he meant
whom
it.
Whom he didn't believe in.
There's one thing that doesn't make your book, and I've always wondered about it. The other towering fisherman in that part of the world in that era was Ernest Hemingway. And he thought he was the greatest fisherman that ever lived. And I never found a record that they met or that they contested.
Well,
or
I have
that
a
they...
slight thing on that. They had a date to go fishing that got interrupted by the revolution. And Ted was interested in Hemingway, and he read a biography of Hemingway written by, I forget who, but he was a close friend of Hemingway's. And I always wondered if Ted was a little jealous of Hemingway's DiMaggio genuflection.
Interesting.
And
the old man.
The old man of the sea, yeah. Referred to the great DiMaggio. But, yeah, they were supposed to meet, but never did.
Speaking of Williams being around, there was one legend in our family. My Aunt Sarah, who introduced us to everything in the world, took us to Storyville one night to hear Errol Garner play the piano. And we were 15, 16, drinking Kitty Collins and non-alcoholic beverages, but it was a wonderful night. And at probably around 11 o'clock, my sister nudged me and said, I think somebody's just come in sitting next to you. And we looked, and there was Ted Williams with this beautiful, beautiful woman come in after the ball game, but intent listener. And it bears on this whole business of worshiping perfection. It turned out many years later that Errol Garner, they were friends. They were good friends.
Yeah.
Somebody asked Errol about his interest in sports, and he said, well, Ted Williams and I are close friends. And he said that advisedly. And he spoke of Williams having become manager of the Washington Senators, used to put a record called Up in Errol's Room on the loudspeaker, and he would tell his hitters, get that rhythm, get that rhythm. But Errol, like Ted Williams, was a complete natural and a complete miracle. And there was something about Williams. Williams was very, very fussy about the people he honored or didn't honor,
mm-hmm.
Or associated with. He loved Stan Getz and others, but that's the mark of his non-monomania. He was a man of some range, actually.
Yeah. Well, I didn't. I hadn't heard that particular story about Garner, but I knew that he loved jazz and greatly admired Garner. And but you could do worse than put on an Errol Garner record to try and get your underlings going.
Well, and, Errol reported with great pleasure that their averages went up when they got into his rhythm.
Well, you know, Williams had a spotty record as a manager, now that you've brought it up. But he was probably the only ball player or only manager to ever have a picture of a sitting president in his office, and that was Richard Nixon, whom he greatly admired, Ted, the arch Republican.
Yeah. No Kennedy fan.
No.
Not one of them.
It's funny, when JFK was elected, Ted had just retired, and he was running a baseball camp down in Lakeville, Mass, on the way towards the Cape. And he got several calls from the White House. JFK wanted to arrange a meeting with Ted at Hyannisport.
Hmm.
And Ted refused to return the call. And finally, the secretary kept saying, well, don't you think that you should return the phone call to the White House? And Ted finally said, just tell him I'm a Nixon man.
Holy mackerel.
And when they had, in September of 1960, as the presidential campaign was winding up, Ted had been invited by Nixon to the AFL-CIO convention in Miami to help him with, the labor vote or something. And JFK was there too. And he flies in to the Miami airport on his plane, and he's with Dave Powers. Mm. And they look out the window, and Ted had just landed to join Nixon. And JFK says to Powers, Dave, look, it's Ted. The son of a bitch has a Nixon button on. So
This would be number six on my Letterman list of just Williams isms. I love the guy for inspiring the finest bit of sports writing in our time from John Updike, who told me some wonderful stories about Ted, but surely it's not an accident that the greatest sports god of our times was defined by the greatest sports prose of our time. And just a fragment from that piece, Hub Fans Bid Kid Adieu. Updike began, "My personal memories of Williams began when I was a boy in Pennsylvania with two last place teams in Philadelphia to keep me company. For me, Williams, left field, was a figment of the box scores who always seemed to be going 3 for 5. For me, Williams is the classic ball player of the game on a hot August weekday before a small crowd when the only thing at stake is the tissue-thin difference between a thing done well and a thing done ill. It may be that compared to such managers' dreams as the manifestly classy Joe DiMaggio and the always helpful Stan Musial, Williams was an icy star. But of all team sports, baseball, with its graceful intermittences of action, its immense and tranquil field sparsely settled with poised men in white, its dispassionate mathematics, seems to me best suited to accommodate and be ornamented by a loner. It is an essentially lonely game. No other player visible to my generation concentrated within himself so much of the sport's poignance, so assiduously refined his natural skills, so constantly brought to the plate that intensity of competence that crowds the throat with joy."
It's such a great piece. I've read it 100 times.
Haven't we
I
all?
I never tire of hearing it.
A couple of things. Updike told me once that he moved to New England from New York when he really, you know, became a writer because he wanted to be in the neighborhood of Hawthorne and Emerson, Thoreau, and all these people. And he said to me flat out that was just kind of a ruse. He wanted to be in range of Ted Williams. He wanted to go to those games, having listened, you know, late at night on a scratchy radio.
And he loved Gowdy. He loved Gowdy's voice.
Yes, he did.
And he referred to it with that cowboy twang, I think, that Gowdy was from Wyoming.
1-1 to Williams. Everybody quiet now here at Fenway Park after they gave him a standing ovation of 2 minutes, knowing that this is probably his last time at bat. One out, nobody on, last of the eighth inning. Jack Fisher into his windup. Here's the pitch. Williams swings, and there's a long drive to deep right. That ball is going, and it is gone. A home run for Ted Williams in his last time at bat in the major league.
I've always been fascinated by the relationship between Updike and Williams and what Ted meant to Updike. And I write in the book about his attending the last game. And Ted's youngest daughter, Claudia, gave me full access to Ted's house as part of my research. Getting Ted's two daughters, Claudia, the youngest, and Bobby Joe, the oldest, were turning points for me in the book because they had never talked before to any journalist, and that opened up a whole new window. But as part of Claudia's cooperation, she came to trust me to the point where she let me be in Ted Williams's house for 8 hours a day, free to rummage through his files. And I found all kinds of nuggets that were like a biographer's dream, like letters from Richard Nixon to Ted, like letters from Updike. And there was one from 1982 in which Ted had invited Updike fishing, but Updike didn't fish and didn't care for it. And the letter said, "Thank you so much for your invitation to come fishing, but the invitation would be wasted on me." But he went on to tell Williams what he had meant to him as a writer, as a person. And he said that a lot of people to this day, this was 1982, still tell him, Updike, that Hub Fans was the best piece of writing he ever did.
I think it's true.
And he went on to thank him for what he had meant to him and for his contributions towards striving for excellence. So I thought that was a very interesting letter. And
there was love there, I mean, of a very high order, I think.
Yeah.
He told me a very funny story, and it's weird because I know many years later he seemed to have forgotten it, but I remember it very, very clearly. He said that he met Williams after the Hub Fans thing came out, not immediately, but not terribly long afterward, and Williams was excited to meet him and thanked him profusely. and admired him. And he said, you have a rare talent. Again, it was this kind of Errol Garner thing, like, you're special. Mm-hmm. You can play in my league, whatever the game is. But then he said something like, you know, you've got a gift and you ought to use it for something important. And I like, looked at him sort of a little stunned. He said, like, what would you suggest? He said, like, save the goddamn Atlantic salmon.
Yeah. Williams was a great conservationist.
Number four on my Letterman list would be Old Timers Game 1983, the only one he ever went to and played in.
82.
Was it 82?
82, yeah.
I took my oldest daughter to the game. I had press privileges from the Channel 2 at the time, and we could walk around the field, and we were just sort of inspecting the scoreboard and stuff, second base and the rest. And suddenly, my daughter just kind of grabbed my arm and said, Daddy, who's that? It was a little panic, but definitely an intuition that this landed from some other place. There was a stature, a spirit, and a beauty about the man that she'd never seen before, which I thought was a mark in her favor. But anyway, later, Peter Gammons, myself, Ralph Houck, Ted Williams, a couple of others maybe, were in that clubhouse. And Ted was back after years of not being ready. He was sort of sitting there with his, you know, those blue-sleeved sweatshirts and whatnot. And what I never forget was simply that he and Ralph Houck had known each other back in the day, but they went through batting situations. He was remembering, especially coming back from the war. People were telling him about Bob Feller. People were telling him about the big stars he hadn't met yet. And he went through them. And this, you know, this day in Chicago or this day in Detroit or Cleveland and the weather, the count, where was Bobby Dorr? Every single thing he could summon again. And he went through it with incredible delight. And again, he was sort of confronting Bob Feller, Rapid Robert again, as if it were real. And I just remember coming out of that clubhouse and saying to Peter Gammons, did you ever hear anything like that? And he said, Chris, I've probably heard 17 or 18 sessions with Williams, and he never repeats a situation. He never repeats a pitch. He remembers them all.
Yeah, it's incredible. He had this astonishing recall for every home run he'd hit. And could tell you practically the day, the inning, the pitch.
Yeah.
And that was amazing, recall.
In our family, we went back to, I barely remembered it, but the 1946 season when they won the pennant, lost the series. But my brother Peter, 3 years older than me, kept a scrapbook of every game and every player. And we always ragged him, still do, about the picture of Ted Williams, which was that handsome devil. I mean, he was the handsomest man I ever saw. And Peter, in his third grade Palmer penmanship, had written under it, team's best long ball hitter, which indeed he was. But that season, I thought Michael Dukakis lost his 88 campaign for president when they asked him, they asked the other guys too, sort of, who's your all-time hero? And he came up with a totally politically correct Jonas Salk. And I was thinking,
Jonas Salk?
Yeah. Not a red sock. He just cured polio, that's all. But anyway, I thought, Michael, get real. You remember 1946. You remember Ted Williams. That's the biggest hero we ever saw. And the funny part was, Dave Ferris, who won 20 games for the Red Sox that year, lived in an attic down a few doors down the street from us in Newton
Center. Boo Ferris, better known as Boo Ferris.
Quote, Boo Ferris.
I just saw him. I just met
him. He's 92 years old or whatever.
Down in Mississippi. Yeah,
wonderful guy. And he would stop. We'd be playing baseball on the street. He would drive home from the Red Sox game, and he signed a ball from our brother Peter, which he still has. But the point was, that same summer, Dom DiMaggio was living in an attic a couple of doors down the street from Michael Dukakis, kid aspiring, you know, Brookline athlete, tennis player and whatnot. And for him to have, I don't know, not to be able to deal with the fact of how we felt about Ted Williams.
Yeah.
Even when he's running for president.
Yeah, he whiffed.
Yeah, he did. He did. But that picture of Williams, that sort of Apollonian beauty, the line drawn against chaos, I mean, this absolutely perfect man.
Well, the 46...
That never goes away.
46 series, of course, was one of his great disappointments when the Red Sox lost in 7 to the Cardinals. But individually, in the game within the game, Ted had a dismal series. He hit 200, and he...
That happens in a... In
it
a...
does. It does. And his some of his critics, like Dave Egan, the AKA the Colonel, used to always just torture him with that series performance. And I don't know if you remember, but the Red Sox clinched the pennant early that year. And they were waiting for the National League series to resolve itself. The Dodgers and the Cardinals were fighting to see who would win the National League pennant. So they brought in a team of all-stars, the Red Sox did, to try and keep sharp, including Joe DiMaggio. And in one of the exhibition games, Ted was hit on the elbow by Mickey Hefner of the Washington Senators, who was a junk baller. But the his elbow swelled up like a balloon, and the press was going crazy and saying that he'd be out for the series. So
Mickey Hefner was worried about getting lynched, probably.
Yeah, but to his credit, Ted never alibied on that. And his elbow was probably hurting him a lot. But, you know, he never got another chance in a series.
Ben, I'm probably over my limit. I just wanted to mention one other thing that was always important to us as a kind of the moral lesson of Ted Williams, which was another season ending, but it was that last doubleheader in 1941 against Philadelphia in Shibe Park. And my father used to tell us this story, and he would always tear up talking about it. He had come into that last game on the verge of the first 400 batting season in modern baseball. It was 399.555 or whatever. Not quite there, but it would have rounded off to 400. And Williams chose to play in a doubleheader. And Connie Mack had told his pitchers, don't do him any favors. 8 at-bats, 6 hits, and a final average that rounded to 406. And you write beautifully about that day, that before any of the formal celebration or they came out of the clubhouse, Williams took his friend Johnny Orlando aside in the clubhouse and said, I'm a good hitter.
The understatement of all times.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was his defining moment. And it was a courageous act. Maybe today some players would have opted to sit and take that. But Ted knew instinctively that there would have been an asterisk to that 400 if he had just simply rounded it up, as Joe Cronin, his manager, was really urging him to do. And he said, no, I'm going to play, and not only play one game, but play two. He could have sat the second game. People wouldn't have squawked. He was safely over. Maybe he was at 403. But he played both games and went 6-for-8, as you say, in what was...
As you say.
Had to have been one of the most courageous performances, and that was his legacy that remains today. No player has hit 400 since then.
This has come up in numerous conversations with the great Harold Bloom, the literary scholar, and, you know, poetic, poet historian, keeper of the canon, tracer of every influence within the whole field of literature. But he's a DiMaggio guy, but we also speak of these people as artists. And it seems to me it's the one thing that we all know about Ted Williams. We can only think of him in terms of the great creators. In Harold Bloom world, it's all about influence and proving individuality against the tradition. And we're all, you know, all the poets are related to Keats or to Shakespeare or in American tradition to Walt Whitman and whatnot. But by those terms, and particularly when you think about Williams actually saying at age 19 or whatever it was, all I want is when I go down the street, people say, that there goes the greatest hitter that ever lived. I said to Harold Bloom one time, that's a strong poet. And he said, that's exactly what we mean by a strong poet, a poet who rises in a certain sense beyond the influences to the ultimate individuality and knows he's doing it all the way.
Yeah. Well, Ted was an artist, and when you speak of individuality, there was always that tension between individual excellence and in a team game. And Williams was criticized by some for not being as much of a leader as, say, DiMaggio was, or not seeming to be as upset after a loss as Joe was. But I think Ted certainly cared about winning as much as the next guy. He just wasn't a rah-rah guy, and he would lead by example. But there's no question that in a bicycle built for nine, as baseball is, a team game, for Williams, the center of the action, the center of the universe, was that competition between hitter and pitcher. That's what it was all about. Right. You know, he was the game's first hitting coach before there was such a position. He was always advising his teammates or helping his teammates right. become better hitters. And he would even help the opposition. One time the Cleveland Indians came to town and Rocky Colavito was in a slump and approached Ted before the game for some tips. And Ted met with him happily and Colavito went out and hit three home runs. His teammate said, Red Sox, what the hell is that all about? But Ted thought hitting was good for the game, whether it was the opposition or...
The other side of it, Ben, and you documented beautifully, is that he could not understand the guys who went up to hit and came back, having struck out or whatever,
right.
and didn't know what the guy was
exactly.
throwing.
Exactly. Dom didn't DiMaggio...
Notice, weren't counting.
Dom DiMaggio and Johnny Pesky, who were my first two interviews, you know, in a project like mine, you got to get the old-timers while they're still alive. And I was at this so long with 600-odd interviews that of that number, maybe 60 died after I interviewed them. But I remember they said very distinctly that Ted was so demanding because, you know, they would hit before him in the order. Ted was the number three hitter, and they would come back to the dugout, and Ted would be all over them. Would the guy strike you out on? And they were, you know, they didn't want to talk because they felt bad about striking out. And half the time they said they couldn't remember what it was. What? You can't remember? You were just up there, says Ted. And he was always trying to gather intelligence on what the guy was throwing and so forth. He was criticized for taking too many walks. It was an interesting debate because Joe DiMaggio would say privately to friends that he thought Ted took too many walks and that the most, when you have your best hitter up in a key situation with men on base, you should be willing to hit an outside pitch because if you didn't and took a walk, you'd be losing a chance for your best hitter to drive in runs. But Ted would make the slippery slope counter argument that if you chased a pitch one inch off the strike zone, it was a victory for the pitcher because next time up, he would make you chase a pitch 2 inches and then 3 inches. And I think the Williams approach was vindicated because in the modern game, in the world of sabermetrics, on-base percentage is the most important statistic. And Ted still has the highest on-base percentage ever in baseball, .482, which means that he was on base either by a hit or a walk, nearly once every two times up. But I got another great Ted Williams story that's slightly off color. Ted was the most profane guy on earth. He was a very creative swearer. He would string words together using just obscene words, including the word syphilitic, which was a favorite of his, in a series of words that would just, it would make, you know, and of course the baseball clubhouse is... no church, but even hard-bitten Red Sox players. I interviewed every teammate who played with Williams still alive, and even some of them would blanch at some of Ted's language. And he may have invented the F word as an adjective, as in, I'm the greatest effing hitter who ever lived. And that phrase came up in a story that I liked. This boy and his mother were out shopping one day in the late 40s, which was Williams's prime. And who do they see but Ted Williams? And the kid, whose name was Tommy, worshipped Williams. And he said, Mom, that's Ted Williams. And so they followed him around for a couple of stores. And... they were very close to him, and they could see what or hear what Ted was saying, and the F-bombs were flying, And the mother was getting more and more nervous as the kid was exposed to this, you know, the language was getting bluer and bluer. And finally, after hearing several Ted rants, the mother turned to Tommy and said, "Now, Tommy, I want you to promise me that you'll never use the F word." Kid stopped for a moment and thought, said, "But Mom, Ted Williams is the greatest fucking hitter who ever lived."
He had a kind of Tourette's syndrome.
Yeah,
with explosive language, profane and otherwise.
He struggled with anger. I think he was probably bipolar before they knew what that was. It was probably rooted in resentment of his mother, who was this Salvation Army zealot out until all hours of the night, saving souls on the streets of San Diego, but never home for Teddy Ballgame or the younger brother, Danny. So they were some of the first latchkey kids waiting for Mom to come home late at night, 10, 11 o'clock at night, to cook them a meal. And the father was a drunk and a ne'er-do-well and not in the picture. And so he struggled with that anger, and there was this sort of Tourette's quality. He was able to use the anger constructively on the baseball field because he always said he hit better mad. Roger Kahn, the writer, said he nurtured his rage. And Ted would pick feuds, say, with the baseball writers who he always thought were out to get him, and then use that as a motivator and go off on a tear and hit 500 for a month. But in his personal life, this anger would bubble up at inappropriate times and places and just come out Tourette's-like and cause them enormous difficulty in human relationships that really counted with his wives, with his kids. But ultimately, I think it's a redemptive tale because he had a kind and good heart, as evidenced chiefly by the work that he did with the Jimmy Fund, in which he would go up to doctors and nurses and give them his phone number and say that if you think any visit from me can help or bring good cheer to these kids who in that era virtually all died, then I will come. And he did. And the writers would find out about it and ask him about it. And he'd say, "Yeah, it's true. But if you write it and it's your ass, I'll never talk to you again." Because he was worried that a story in the papers would make it appear like he was feathering his own nest or trying to temper his Peck's bad boy image. And this was genuine. He really cared about that, these kids. And beyond his skill as a baseball hitter, he resonated with people. He would make as much news off the field as he would on. There were 9 papers back in the day. You'll remember this. 9 morning and afternoon papers in Boston. And if Ted Williams burped, he was on the front page. And he had just this personality that transcended the baseball field. You know, he was a star in every sense of the term. He was a prickly prima donna who couldn't take criticism well. He reasoned that he was the best at what he did and was trying to do his best, and therefore any boos were unfair. And therefore he was so unlike the modern professional athlete who was trained to turn the other cheek against any criticism. Like when A-Rod comes up to Fenway Park, I mean, he's subjected to, and I'm no A-Rod fan, God knows, but the level of invective that one hears when A-Rod comes to bat at Fenway Park is unbelievable. But he turns the other cheek. Ted had these so-called rabbit ears where he could hear one boo out of the chorus of cheers, and he would turn on the guy, and if somebody was cussing him out, Ted would flip him the bird. I mean, this is unheard of today. And spit. And, you know, he had several very famous public meltdowns at Fenway Park. He was a diva. When you look at the arc of his career, it's different from other superstar athletes who, when they retire, fade away. Ted, paradoxically, watched his popularity grow exponentially in retirement. And he was always puzzled by that, that when he returned to Boston, he was greeted as a godlike figure, more so than in his playing days, when he still suffered from these meltdowns and, you know, a minority thought that he was pop off and set a bad example for kids and so forth. But I think people came to realize that Ted had this fragile psyche, and they came to embrace him and feel a sense of appreciation for what they had had. And this was an original. This was an American original.
Three cheers for Ted Williams, Ben Bradley. Three cheers for your book. Three cheers for Extraordinary Luck. I saw him hit number 517 in 1960, just about Labor Day, off Don Lee of the Washington Senators. It was a thrill. And it's a thrill to sit and yammer. We can always hang out on the porch and talk Williams stories.
Yeah, that's right. Ted was a great one, and there are a million stories.
Thank you for all of these, Ben.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Great to see you again.
We're going out on some of the music that Ted Williams loved, music that he believed specifically could help hitters if they just absorb its energetic rhythm. This is Errol Garner playing his own tune called Up in Errol's Room. This conversation was produced and edited by Mary McGrath. Please visit our website and check out our many podcasts and conversations, and you can subscribe to them on iTunes. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of this open source podcast project.